This is Opera Talks Back, Silent Night Talks, our first conversation with Julie Adams, who sings Anna in Silent Night, Kirk Doherty, who sings Sprink in Silent Night. We're recording this on Monday, January 30th, 2017, in my office, and I'm Larry Hancock. Welcome to Opera Talks.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Larry.
The folks we have here talking with us today are Julie Adams and Kirk Doherty.
Hi.
Hi.
Julie is going to be singing Anna Sorensen in Silent Night, and Kirk is going to be singing her love life, who is Nikolaus Sprink.
Yes.
In the same opera. Can you imagine you're both in the same opera at the same time?
Amazing.
Amazing. I love it.
So, Julie, I've been looking at your bio. You've been singing a lot of stuff. The range of things, from Blanche DuBois to Mimi in La Boheme to Yanufa to Pamina in The Magic Flute.
I know, it's fun. I'm very lucky.
Yeah, quite a lot of stuff. Really impressive. And you've won some kind of important awards. You won the Met Audition, the George London, the Sarah Tucker, and Elizabeth Connell for Dramatic Sopranos.
Yes. Yes, yes. Thank you.
Yeah, all that good stuff is happening to you. And you're only, what, 14?
28. Getting on up there.
Nice. 28. We have a lot of really young people in our cast. With Colin Ramsay, who is, I think, 27.
Yeah, he's, Brian, he's only a couple years younger than me. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Brian Meyer, who's, I think, 28 also, something like that. Mm-hmm. A lot of young people. Mm-hmm. Kirk.
Yes.
3 seasons at Opera San Jose. You've done so many roles, we can't count them all.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Yeah.
But most, the 2 most recent Bel Canto roles, Edgardo in Lucia and Almaviva in The Barber of Seville.
Gorgeous.
Yeah, and so I think Almaviva was a surprise for you.
Oh, well, yeah, it was really good, something different and a good stretch, and I enjoyed a lot.
It was the Edgardo that was the surprise for me.
Oh, yeah.
I knew you would be good, but I had no idea.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
Did you see this boy in his Edgardo?
I did not, unfortunately, but Kirk is amazing. I watch him in rehearsal, and I obviously get to, most of our scenes are together, and he, every single moment is spot on and has such an incredible voice. I mean, really, it's an honor to share the stage with him. I'm amazed
my pleasure
at his talent.
Thank you. It's huge.
It's anything he sings is like
really
gold.
Appreciate
so
it.
I'm sure it was spectacular.
I really enjoyed working with you too. It's really great. You sound fantastic and
you
present a beautiful character. So.
Thank you. Feelings mutual.
Thank you.
I think the whole cast.
Oh, wow.
You know? I mean,
absolutely.
We have 50 men.
Absolutely.
There are 50 men. And some dead ones.
Yeah, and from all over the country. The cast is from. I've known many guys from other regional places. And of course, New York is a big place where people audition, often in December, but in other months as well. And it's just nice to see these people again and work with them in the same room.
The surprise for us when we started announcing that we were looking for singers for Silent Night is we're accustomed to having to search out singers who would consider the role. When we announced Silent Night, it was the opposite. We got all these calls from guys who had done it before who wanted to be in the cast again.
I mean, I can see why. I think it's just been such an incredible journey for me. I mean, when I was first presented about doing this role, I had only heard bits and pieces about it. I heard that it was a smashing success in Minnesota, and I had some friends that were actually in that, one of them being AJ Gluckert, who's a friend of mine, and he was saying, you know, the music is absolutely beautiful. And I said, well, you know, I got to admit, at first I was hesitant because I thought, modern opera, I don't know. I just because I'm such a traditionalist and I love me a beautiful melodic line, and oftentimes, not always, but more often than not, modern music is very hard for me to enjoy. So I took on the role, and I have just been so thankful that I decided to do this, because it is probably, besides, I would say, singing Blanche, it's becoming my favorite role in the sense of emotionally, physically, everything about it is absolutely stunning. And there's this story, I think, is just so gorgeous and so pertinent to what's going on in our world today, that people need to come and see this. And, you know, I'm tired of seeing what's going on in the world right now, but I come to rehearsal and it just adds a level of that character for me. And it's just, I cannot express how beautiful this opera is, really, and the theater. And I cannot get through a rehearsal yet without crying, but it's very cathartic in a way. Mm. It's absolutely gorgeous. I really have no other words other than it's just been such a highlight for me to make music and share the stage with such incredible artists from all over. And we have an incredible show.
So. Yeah, and we have a stage director and a conductor who get it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Amen.
And no, Robert Mulacony.
Wow. Yeah.
Bob's assistant great. Conductor Robert Mulacony, mm-hmm. who at the piano is a wizard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolute wizard at the piano.
Absolutely.
It doesn't matter how hard it is. He's just flying through it. No, it's perfect. True.
There's really nothing he can't do.
It's astonishing, isn't it?
Yes.
And that's an issue in a lot of modern opera because the repetiteur at the piano is definitely going to be an important part of your understanding what to listen to and when to not listen or when to watch the cues of the conductor. And so to get an accurate a playing of a reduced orchestration for rehearsal purposes is huge. And Bob's fantastic at that. Mm-hmm. As well as being a fantastic conductor.
And to echo off of that, I mean, for those listening, this score is actually very hard musically. Yeah. And a lot of the times, in traditional music, I would say, you know, Puccini and Mozart, you have the singers often can find their parts in the orchestra and you can hear your part. This opera has been very difficult rhythmically, musically, pitch-wise. You know, oftentimes what we're singing is going so against the orchestra that it's muscle memory at this point. And I have to say, every time Bob is there and he's, you know, nope, that pitch wasn't quite correct, or you know, he's singing it right, you know, perfect pitch man out of thin air. He's like, "This is your pitch, go!" And so, absolutely, and our incredible pianists on the show and everybody, it's
Veronica, Victoria,
it's
pianist.
Tough, and everyone has taken this on so incredibly well.
They stepped right up.
No, it's rare that you see. Let's say the traditional operas like Lucia di Lammermoor or Barbara of Seville, it's rare you see people say, "Oh, I don't know about that. That might not have been real enough. I want to make this." You know, those moments mm-hmm. happen though, definitely in this piece, because the drama on stage has to have the sense of reality unfolding in time, like a normal kind of almost cinematic kind of experience. Mm-hmm. So people really like to believe each of those moments.
Cinema is costing opera a lot of money.
That's true.
Because now the mode of storytelling now has crept in so much from the film mm-hmm. industry.
Yeah, it's the expectation.
And now that television has really stepped up with things like The Crown and that kind of storytelling is now expected no matter where you go. And it's really hard to do in a physical space with a theater. It's not light on a screen. Mm-hmm. These are human beings and they don't disappear. The scenery doesn't disappear.
Absolutely.
It's very costly. It's very challenging, and you have to have smart people. And our set designer, Stephen Kemp.
Oh, beautiful. Beautiful.
Yeah, that's Michael a great Schell. Set. Man, those boys, you know, they worked 2 years on that set design.
One can tell immediately.
It's
because
it's extremely thought out.
The quality of the individual bunkers, trenches, each characterization of each nation has its own various trench look. Mm-hmm. And
drawn from history, drawn from research. Yes. The Germans got there first.
Mm-hmm. So
they had the high ground. Mm-hmm. And they were over massive chalk deposits. The White Cliffs of Dover is the same land, right? So it's all chalk under there. And they were able to burrow giant caves all opening onto their trenches, whereas the French arrived lower ground. When they dug down, guess what they found? A water table.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And then the Scots arrived, the British arrived last in our production. They're from Scotland. And they arrived last of all. They had no time. They just had some shovels and quickly dug some trenches to hide in,
Here we go.
Yeah.
So you see exactly reflected in the history of what went on. It's in the trenches. If you Exactly. Take the time to look.
But I love that, though. I think that's what's so special.
No, yeah. There's a kind of metallic covering to the German trench. There's a certain thatching of branches to the French trench, and a kind of makeshift sort of Scottish thing. I was going to say that, but I didn't say it.
whatever they could find.
But it's a very lived-in universe. It's a very lived-in universe for
we
that.
We left out the 10,000 rats.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And the water.
and nobody's sloshing in water. So, but that verisimilitude. And the rifles, I have a military veterans chorus.
Yes.
We meet on Sunday nights. And so I brought them back into the rehearsal hall a couple of weeks ago because they're all coming to see Silent Night.
Oh, great.
Wonderful.
And this one guy, these are lifers. Okay, many of these people have been, I mean, all the way back to World War II.
Oh, wow.
Sure.
I have World War II. I have Vietnam. I have Korea. I have Iraq, Afghanistan. I have people from all those wars. Mm-hmm. And he walked in, and at first, the first thing he saw was the machine gun mounted on the German trench, right? He said, "Where did you get that?"
yeah.
Well, that must be good.
That's exactly. Terrific.
I mean, amen to our props department.
Yeah.
He literally walked right up to it to, what is that?
How did that? Yeah.
And I said, no, they built it. They built it down the street. And then he looked at all of our rifles and he said, "You can't tell them. I mean, you have to get right up on them to know they're not functional weapons." And of course, they are nothing.
Absolutely.
They don't have firing pins. They are not functional weapons, but they look like it.
They really have
the look of a rifle.
And
from that time,
really, like you can even hear, especially one of our scenes when Horst Myers, the click.
The bolt action. Yeah.
Yep. It's sorry for my naivety. I don't know anything about guns.
Yeah.
With you. Oh, listen. When I figured out I was going to be doing an opera about a war, I mean, it's my fault, right? I mean, I'm the guy who said we have to do this,
right?
And I was about a war. I said, "What do I know about a war?" Absolutely. Well, I mean, give me a book on a war, and it's kind of like giving a Mormon a book of recipes for cocktails made with coffee.
Yes.
I mean, it's just completely useless. What am I going to do a book about war? But you know what? Now I've read 6, and I can't tell you, probably 20 hours, maybe more, of documentaries on this war.
It's amazing.
And
well, for many of the soldiers in this production, many of the singers that play these soldiers in this production, I mean, it's like thinking about things we haven't thought about in 10, 20 years. When we watched that war movie, thought about other things besides your standard opera rep, you know, and to get to play in this sort of environment. It's been just really fun. 40 guys in a room playing at war, trying to create as realistic a drama as possible.
Oh, and you're good with a knife.
Oh, yeah, that's God. Really well, scary.
That, it reminds me of Tosca.
Well,
you went for this boy, huh?
Yeah, you're right. The trench knife scene, there's a lot of very good action on stage in about choreographed to 5 minutes of war music, which is completely and totally composed in the score by the composer. All the style writing actually is, I think, by the composer, Kevin Putz.
That brings us to an interesting point. Mm-hmm. Kevin Putz writes in the style of, and you can name it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they're very identifiable.
And you hear it and you think, what is my first experience when we got the DVD here? I did not know the opera, right? Mm-hmm. I knew about the opera, but I didn't know the work. Mm-hmm. And the PBS thing had been, and Minnesota was kind enough to send me a DVD of the public broadcast.
Oh, right, okay.
So they sent that to me. I was just more curious than anything else, didn't know anything about it, but it was being produced everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, 11 productions in 5 years for a new work?
Mm-hmm.
What?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and major companies.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, and there was a reason it was major companies. Anyway, I got called out just as it was being put on, and you know, we're just beginning, you know, the identifying credits, Minnesota Opera, la la. I got a phone call, and I had to step out and take it. When I came back in, they had this Salieri opera up. I said, "What are you doing?" You know, and everybody was staring at the TV like it was something.
Yeah,
and I said, "Going, why are we? Why?" What? And then the guy walks out and announces that they're at war,
but we're still in the same opera.
Yeah,
yeah.
But all the way through, When he decides to write like Bach, you think it's Bach. Mm-hmm. When he decides to write like Strauss, you think it's Strauss.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. He really does it. And then he twists it.
Uh-huh. Right? Absolutely, yeah.
And that was when the first time I was watching this, I was, I don't know, 15 minutes in, I was going, oh, this is different. Mm-hmm. This is a different kind of storytelling. Mm-hmm. This is not the kind of storytelling I see when I go to an opera, mm-hmm. any opera. Mm-hmm. And about another 15 or 20 minutes in, the thought kept coming into my head, I wonder if this is what the public felt when they went to La Scala and saw Nabucco for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
A right. whole new voice in opera.
It mm-hmm. absolutely is.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, even the just as the scene has different national characters to its props and the bunkers and the trenches. I mean, the music itself has a national character to each of the languages that the people are speaking in, mm-hmm. and it really describes the thoughts of the characters with the musical language of a French style, of a German style, of a Scottish style.
Yeah, you hear it all.
Yeah.
And haven't supertitles just set us free? Everybody gets to speak in their native tongue.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Even Latin, you know, for the mm-hmm. priest. Mm-hmm. So, and we're able to just look up and see it in English, and we're fine.
Mm-hmm.
But yet we hear the German. I find myself walking around the office speaking in German.
Because
it's been a long, 45 years since I had my last German class. But it brings it all back.
It does.
Mm-hmm. Brings it all back. And it's conversational. It's just people talking to each other.
Yeah, it really is set in a way that it could come straight off of the screen to into the theater.
Mm-hmm.
One of the guys said to me, "This needs to be playing on Branch Fields." He said, "This needs to be playing on Broadway."
Yeah, yeah, I'd love it.
I think so.
Yeah, it's topical to the world that is now, because we're coming out of a time period where it was two global superpowers. The origins of that are just the beginnings of the two world wars, and this is this kind of time period. Yeah,
the world we live in happened because mm-hmm. of World War One.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It changed everything. It's our obsession with ever more powerful weapons.
Yeah,
that began with World War One. And it continues to this day, an obsession. Who can make mm-hmm. the most powerful weapons?
Yeah.
And who can keep the long, the biggest standing army?
In
reading all these books. But an important book to read to understand this is Barbara Tuchman's The Proud Tower.
Mm.
And that's the whole situation that led us to a war, right? Mm-hmm. It's not about the war. The Guns of August is the next book, and that's about the war.
Mm-hmm.
But leading it up. And there's a preface to a book that was written by the Crown Prince,
mm-hmm.
played by Chris Mingochea?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
And
wonderful.
I read this preface and I thought, this could have been written in November in the United States, about the United States.
Yes.
About the need to maintain the strongest standing army in the world.
Yeah.
And our right to rule the world.
Yeah, there's a rise in nationalism that hasn't been even thought of since the beginnings of World War One. That is today's news.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it is today's news, and I'll tell you what: studying all these books, and preparing, and looking at this thing, and understanding the role so that I could help cast them. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's mm-hmm. my job. Help to find the stage director who could do this sort of thing. I had to do a fair amount of reading before I could approach it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm doing this while we're having one of the most revealing presidential campaigns, mm-hmm. certainly of my life.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I'm reading about all this build up to war, mm-hmm. and I'm watching this thing, and it completely changed me as a person, because I've always been a person who felt that he should not be involved in the national discussion about politics and things like that, that I was separated from that. Mm-hmm. I went mm-hmm. into art on purpose. I didn't want to go. I was 18 in 1968, so the height of the Vietnam
mm-hmm.
you know, stuff. And I separated myself from all that ugliness in a school of music. I basically was in a monastery mm-hmm. just studying mm-hmm. how to play the piano and how to sing, right? And I exempted myself from all those things. I mean, I remember once somebody challenged me, because we were sitting at a table, four of us together, and somebody was talking about something that had happened in Vietnam, and I was all ears, and it was all news to me, and they saw me listening, you know, intently, and they said, well, what do you think about it, Larry? And I said, I'm just finding out for the first time. And he says, what are you, a Democrat or a Republican? Wow. And one of the guys at the table said, oh, Larry's neither one. He's an aristocrat.
I like that.
There is a truth, though, that's mm-hmm. very easy to be apolitical as an artist, you know, to
we think we float above all that stuff.
Yeah.
We don't.
No. I mean, mm-hmm. or to communicate to both, you know, or to many points of view. You feel like you should have a certain distance from society's politics, civilization's politics. But it's hard to really separate oneself in the context of this story from that, because this story revolves around so much of politics, and many of the actions of the characters within the story, they occur because of their own society and civilization's politics.
Michael Schell was talking to the Friends of Opera last night, mm-hmm. and he was saying, mm-hmm. as he was looking at this, he was trying to figure out what is the point of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying, is it pro-war? Is it against war? And ultimately he said, no, mm-hmm. it's neither of those. Mm-hmm. It's about humanity.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He opened our first meet and greet, if you will, when he introduced himself, and we introduced the cast to everybody. And he said this sentence, and he said, the opera is about what does it mean to be a human being? And I sat and I just thought about that, and I was like, he hit it on the head. I couldn't have said it better. And I think that's why I have developed such a strong connection to this opera, is because you just see the beautiful connections being made on stage, of these human being connections, no matter where you're from, your, you know, what mm-hmm. race you are, what you believe in.
Yeah.
These men playing having a soccer match together, realizing, mm-hmm. oh, you have a wife too. I do. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating and so beautiful. And yeah. At the end of the day, though, and especially in the world right now, that's what it is. What does it mean to be a human being? And yeah. that's
and,
why I
had to remember
yes.
that all people are.
Absolutely.
That's the trick.
And I think yeah. to echo what you were just saying before this, I think that's why I admire so much Anna and Sprink's relationship, because you, Kirk, and Sprink is so strong. He stands up to the Lieutenant Horstmeier so many times.
Yeah.
And he's like, what is this for? You know, and mm-hmm. and Anna's strength and just going with him and saying, no, love is what matters. And I'm going to go with you. As long as I'm with you, the rest doesn't matter.
Yeah, there's a very romantic element to the mm-hmm. story. It's got a certain, I don't know if there's a genre of opera film noir, but it does have a certain
yes.
kind of mid-20th century film noir mm-hmm. to it, because there's a lot of, you know, at one point or another, a person that's on the sidelines of things decides they're going to take an action.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens because he's inspired by the people around him and the love between two people.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that struck me strongest, of course, I don't spend a lot of time in rehearsals. I walk in the back behind everybody because I want to make people nervous. I know in the days when Irene Dallas, my boss, would walk into rehearsals, everybody would just start forgetting their lines.
To happen.
Yeah.
Your job is on the line.
Yes. Yes.
And it's so not certain, true. It's just
right,
so not true. But everybody gets so upset.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, I was once advised by a staff member that I should stay out of rehearsals because I make everybody nervous. Yeah. I said, well, except that my job is on the line.
No, that's
those
right.
rehearsals matter yes. to my job. I'm certainly going to be there.
It takes a lot of courage. I appreciate that, Larry.
Yeah. No, I have to
it
be
does.
There. Obviously, I have to know what's going on.
It does.
And because sometimes there might be something that I could fix now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
That if I wait until we're in the theater, I can't fix it.
Absolutely. Oh, that's true. No, that's true. Absolutely.
I have to know what's going on.
Though I bet in the first 3 hours, in the first 3 days, you'd have been like, oh my God, these people are crazy. That's just the battle scene.
I don't even go in the room the first week. I stay out of the room for the whole first
that's
week.
That's great.
But the second 2 weeks, I'm in every single day.
Well, then you'll see everybody really get shot.
And then when it's time for an act run, that's I'm there for the whole run, right? For the act run. And when it's time for the run-throughs, I was on Friday night, I was there with all the covers for their run.
That was great to see.
Saturday I was in again for the real run with all the chorus present. But I have to tell you, on Friday night they only had all the covers, right?
Right.
So, and no chorus. So I'm sitting there and the sleep chorus comes in. So Oda Bear is on stage and he says, God, if I could only just get some sleep.
Yeah.
And the men are seated all around the room because they're not in the scene. And the chorus starts to rise up around me. That splendid,
oh my God,
piece
it's
of
beautiful
choral music.
It's so stunning.
It's very good
and
very tuneful.
Purely from the melting beauty of that moment, you break down.
Oh, absolutely!
It's just because of the
every
beauty.
Time.
And I'll tell you what: for the past 100 years. People have been trying to convince me that beauty has no intrinsic value. They have been trying to tell me through architecture, through sculpture, through painting, through music. They've been trying to convince me that beauty has no intrinsic value. And I have always known they were lying to me. And Kevin Putz put it in my head that that's what they've been trying to do, and they are wrong. Beauty has intrinsic value of its own, pure, plain, and simple. No representation, no symbolism, no, not even a context. Beauty on its own is valuable.
Yeah, no, that definitely, that chorus is beautiful.
And then you take that great beauty and put it in the context of what these men have just gone through.
Yeah, that's right.
And you can't stand
that's right.
it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and Oda Bear's aria right before that. Oh my gosh. There's
The reason he wants to sleep
it's
is
based off of this one three note theme that keeps repeating. That is absolutely brilliant and so gorgeous. And then you can go to your aria at the end. And
and you finish it. Yeah.
That's really nice.
I can't, I mean, I thank goodness my back is to the audience, because for those of you coming to see the show, if you were to see me turn around, my face is a blubbery, sobbing, wet mess, because
I know. It's really
I can't help but every time Kirk sings it so gorgeously and perfect every time, I just, I have tears in my eyes and I cannot help myself, but it is from what he is saying and from, what you are singing about, and to your voice is just stunning. I mean,
thanks.
Kevin Putz really is, I got to hand it to him, really is a genius.
It's a style that's very, nationally very French. And then Julie has a fantastic German style lament. That
is it's very Strauss-like.
And I that's... Luckily, I'm not on stage at that particular moment, because it really is, it affects me just as much to see her go pick up these letters from these fallen men and take them and then ponder her own future. You know, those are really tender moments in the show that could only happen from these intense battle scenes, and then you put them in this context, and then you have a composer that writes in these national styles so well. It's very moving.
And love.
And of course, very well sung and beautifully sung.
Yeah.
Thank you, darling.
And
thank you.
Oda Bear is in love with his wife.
Oh.
Yeah.
And the other productions I've seen, I perhaps didn't notice it because it was so new to me. And, you know, when you see something more than once, you see more in it,
right?
layers. But I'm looking at this, and the Oda Bear is so in love with his wife, who he has left at about 8 months pregnant. And he doesn't even know if she's had the child or not, if she survived childbirth, if the, did the child survive. He doesn't know any of that.
Right.
And he is so concerned about his wife. And I just didn't see it before in the other productions. And I'm looking at it here and I'm going, oh, Christ. Everyone's life is at stake. Everybody's life is at stake, period. Every single person in the show, their life is at stake. And when you catapult that up with the fact that they love each other so dearly, mm-hmm. and even one another. I mean, there's Jonathan and his brother. I mean, there's all these
all
layers.
Stories mm-hmm. of love.
Mm-hmm. All these layers.
Different kinds
and
of love.
Yeah. That's why you realize that this senseless killing of World War One.
Oh, absolutely.
Was yeah, so tragic.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's crazy when you have the majors come in and then they hear from all the, you know, their lieutenants that, you know, everybody's getting along, and, you know, those scenes is still that gets me is Ponchal's death and having our brilliant Vitali, who is the British major. Come on, he is just so perfect. He shouts on stage, "Kill him, kill him!" And he's so vicious. And I'm sure that that's probably what it was like back in the day. And when you see Ponchal, it's a knife in your heart. It's a lot.
No, it's very moving, and the depiction of all the different levels of society, the high command versus the mid-level soldier, and then the privates and the conscripted people and volunteers, they're all portrayed in a way that gives each person equal time to present themselves to the audience and to tell the story. That's unusual in opera. A lot of operas focus on maybe three or four main characters with some, you know, bits for other people, but there's an equity to all levels of society
and
all civilizations in this show.
The choristers have their solo work going on.
Yes.
Yeah,
the chorus
is a great ensemble show. I mean, and I love that there's so many different stories going on throughout. It's really, really wonderful.
So it's making me very nervous to meet Mr. Putz. So I've decided that the music director can pick him up at the airport.
I mean, I know. It's kind of like I am too. When I found out he was coming to the show, I was like, oh my goodness. I hope. I mean, I'm so thrilled, but I'm also, I mean, I can't lie. That does add a little bit of pressure.
Of course it does.
To make sure that I'm doing his music justice, so he's not sitting in the audience going, well, that girl's really not great. Like,
no.
I think all of us are a little on edge.
Yes.
Both Mr. Campbell and Mr. Putz.
Mr.
How great.
Will be here too. Fantastic. Wow.
Wow.
So get the words right.
Yeah. In all languages.
Right.
Yeah, it's amazing.
You guys are aware
production.
That there's a series of four panels on Friday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they're both on the final panel with Michael and Joe Marchesso. So
how
that's
great.
The final panel. The third panel of the day is Secretary of Defense William Perry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. Former Secretary of Defense in the
U.S. Secretary
of
Defense.
U.S., yeah.
So that's a big deal.
I think. Yeah.
Wow.
That man is coming. It turns out he's a subscriber and a major donor to Opera San Jose.
Well, fantastic.
How wonderful.
Thank you so much.
And, yeah. And when I approached him through one of our own trustees who knows him well, or at least knows him well enough, and I was invited to lunch with the two of them, and
really?
I proposed that he might give this be part of our symposium day, he said, absolutely, I would love to do that.
That's great.
And so he's coming and he's planning to do the whole thing, because that evening is also the general director's dinner on the stage amid the scenery.
Cool.
Isn't that totally cool?
Yeah.
So that's our one big fundraiser a year, that the general director's dinner. That's the $500 plate fancy schmancy party, right?
Oh, how fun.
So, but at 2 in the afternoon, we have these four symposiums. The first one is, you know, Mark Straczynski from West Edge?
Yeah.
And Georgia Rowe, who writes for Opera News and other papers. And and this Mr. Shore, who's coming from, he writes for Opera Today.
Oh, right.
So they're forming a panel, and they'll be addressing what they know about contemporary work, the stuff that they see, because they're reviewing it all the time, right? And Mark's always on the lookout to produce.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that's that panel. And then we have a panel of the designers, minus costumes, because she's in New York, right? But anyway, we'll have the stage director and the designers talking about design.
I'm so excited.
And then the Secretary of Defense is going to talk, I think, mostly about the nuclear threat today.
Mm.
Wonderful.
And then finally, the composer and librettist. So that'll be fun. You guys are obviously competent if you want to go, but it's $20 if you
sure.
Yeah, thank you.
For everybody
that
else.
That sounds amazing.
Mm-hmm. But of course, you should probably be resting. It's the day before your opening. So anyway, that's kind of cool to have that kind of attention.
That
to
is.
Have a Secretary yeah. of Defense walking in to want to talk with us about war. And he, of course, he was one of the people actually who was hoping we would do this opera.
Well, that's fantastic. I'd love to hear his thoughts. And that's
and
fantastic.
Carol Frank Buck, who funded, who made it possible for us to do the opera. Mm-hmm. We just couldn't afford it. It's too big. And she made it possible for us to do this with a grant from her foundation. So she's
fantastic.
Also coming.
Thank you. That's wonderful.
She'll be at the opening.
I look forward to meeting her.
We're all absolutely astoundingly grateful.
Oh, absolutely.
To give us the opportunity to do this thing.
Yeah. It's like so no other opera that is being done right now.
Absolutely.
And you realize both of you are ideal for the roles that you're in. You're absolutely ideal. I'm not talking about the fact that... With no concessions, the fact that you're young, the fact that you're whatever you are, that's not part of the conversation. You're ideal for these roles.
Yeah.
Which is something we try to do at Opera San Jose. I mean, we try not to bring an opera that, gosh, we should have brought a more experienced, older person. We try not to bring those. We bring the operas that we know these people can stand up and do it.
Sure. Thank you.
And so far, we've been very lucky for the past 2 years and a half of being able to assemble those kinds of casts. Wow. Corey Dastoor.
She's really wonderful.
Pulse on who's out there and what they can do.
Absolutely.
God bless her.
Well, it's an honor. It's an honor. Yeah. So thank you. Thank you for having me. It's just such an honor to sing this role and perform with you guys. So
what a pleasure, though.
I can't wait.
Thank you. I feel lucky, too. I feel so lucky. It's great. It's a great show.
Well, I think we should stop.
Yeah.
There we go.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's so great.
All right. Thanks for coming. Bye-bye.
My pleasure.